Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting with Sarah McJulie. And we're across from B.M.Carroll or Burr Carroll. Welcome, Burr.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Sarah.
I don't want to be calling you B.M.
No, don't call me B.M.
Well, I mean, BM, I would probably be the way to say it.
I'll go with Burr. I'm going to stay with Burr.
Yeah.
So you've been published many, many times under the name Burr Carroll. Why have you suddenly gone with B.M. with the missing pieces of Sophie McCarthy?
The book felt very different from day one, and I wanted to announce to my readers and to my publisher, and actually to myself as well, that it was a different book. So I was the person who put the B.M. Carroll in the front right from day one. And the book felt straight from the first page, had a lot more suspense, a lot more at stake. And I thought it was important to distinguish it from my other books.
So people don't get a shock?
It's not deeply shocking, but it is different. Mm-hmm. And the publisher has categorized it as a psychological thriller drama. And my previous books were contemporary fiction. So if you're with my other books, I had main characters, you know, and a lot of things happened to them, and they were in all sorts of trouble and fixes, but they were essentially likable. Whereas with Sophie, the reader isn't sure whether to like Sophie or not. So it was very different for me to write a character where it was such a complex character, and the level of suspense was so, a big part of the book. So I thought it was important for readers to realize it was a different type of book.
And how did that come about? Did you have, was there a period where you were just thinking about this character and thinking, this isn't my kind of character, what's going on here? Or was it a choice of yours to shake things up in your writing?
It was a choice, and it just happened. The book came out really quickly. Mm-hmm. I had a really strong sense of Sophie right from day one. I've worked with Sophies. We all know Sophie, right? We all know her from work. We all know Sophies, probably even from school.
So before we go into
Sophie, let's talk about Sophie. Yeah, because and the book.
Yeah, because we're all ahead of everyone else. Can you give us a little bit of a? It's one of those books where we don't want to give too much away, but can you give just a sort of setup?
It is. I'm finding it really hard to talk about the book because of avoiding spoilers. The main protagonist in the book is Sophie McCarthy, and Sophie is this person who we all, half admire and half hate. There's a lot to admire about her. She's a very hard worker and gets things done. She has a brilliant mind, and she calls things as they are, even though it doesn't always make her popular. One thing that's pulling her back is that she's in an awful lot of pain. Every day she was involved in an incident, and she was badly injured due to the carelessness of somebody else. And what happened has had a very deep impact on her. She can't work with the same vigor as what she once worked, and she can't, have the same relationships that she once had. She's very irritable. She's in a lot of pain. She can't go to the gym. She can't do a lot of physical exercise. So it's impacted her life in every way. And the person who is responsible for her pain is Aidan Ryan. And his life has gone on as before. So it's really the story revolves around Sophie and Aidan, and Sophie's family and Aidan's family, and the impact this particular incident has had on everybody, and the whole idea of fairness, what's fair, what's not fair, because it struck me as very unfair in this particular scenario that Aidan should walk away scot-free without his life being impacted in any way.
Well done. I mean, I was listening to that going, was she going to fall off? I was watching you go across on a tightrope, right across this gorge where there was spoilers at every turn. But
yes,
you made it.
Well, I made it. It's the first time with a book like this that I've not been able to just go blah.
Yeah,
it's too much. Yeah. Too many little hidden twists and turns.
Yeah.
And we can talk vaguely around construction, because it is a book that looks like it took a lot of work to actually get all the pieces in the right place, missing pieces, all the pieces in the right places to build this story. Did that idea of the structure of the book come with with the first draft, or was it something that you worked into it? Because every character sort of gets a point of view.
Yeah, it came from the first draft, yeah. And straight away there was a lot of voices telling the story. And there was even more voices. Yeah. A couple of voices got axed during the editing, yeah. Which made it a very difficult process to ax those voices. I think there was maybe another two voices that were axed during the editing process. But I was at a writing conference recently, and the presenter at that writing conference told me, well, you've broken every rule in the book with your new novel, with all these different perspectives. But to me, it just felt like the right way to tell the story. And it did take a bit of finessing. I had to go back afterwards and look at each one of those voices and make sure that they were consistent. Mm-hmm. And I had all, you know, the types of things that they would say, and had to go back and, you know, and so far nobody's criticized me for, you know, any of the voices sounding too similar or it being confusing. So it came out like that. I wrote it like that. But because it was written like that, editing it was extremely difficult and caused a lot of grey hairs and sleepless nights. So my favourite book to write, my least favourite book to edit.
Yeah. Well, the great thing about the different points of view is you're almost commenting on how limited our understanding of other people are at all times. Like I said, we have these assumptions about what other people are doing and why they're doing it. They're just so wrong all the time. And in this book, you use that to generate this drama and this suspense as you're going through. Because for a few pages, we ride with someone and we're completely convinced their point of view is spot on. And then you flip side and you get someone else's point of view and you're like, no, no, you're right. Sorry, the other guy was completely wrong.
They kind of all are right for themselves.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you do towards the end of the book, that gets even trickier because the action needs to happen, but you've got to be really careful whose eyes you're seeing it through. And particularly in the climax of the book, the editors were saying, oh, do you want to, you know, flip back to this person now at this point? Should we be hearing from them? And I was like, well, no, you can't hear from them because they'll ruin the, you know, what's happening over here. And so it was
That's tricky. A weaving job. I could feel that at the end. How you have to know, you know, this, we can't have that particular stream come through at this point.
Yeah.
And did you find that you were kind of, I suppose in the writing process it wasn't, but in the editing process, losing space to actually tell the story?
Yes, the editing was really difficult. Very difficult to fold two extra voices into the existing voices and try to figure out how would other people know what they know and contribute what they've contributed to the story. And then at the end, particularly with the climax, it's very hard to even extend the climax because I was really limited as to who could be present during that action.
Again, you're turning around but doing it so well.
Yeah.
As hard as it must be to keep track of all of that and the editing process, that's what makes it amazing to read, though, because when you're reading it, it's just unfolding, like, effortlessly, and all you have to do is try and, like, join the dots and figure it out. But what always amazes me with a book like this is how you decide when to reveal the information at the best point. Like, how do you know when's too early and when's too late? And
yeah, I was learning that as I was writing this book. So I have had a little bit of suspense in my previous books, but only just a little.
You need to have something.
But I've always, like, I suppose, even though they're being contemporary fiction, I've always quite liked the fact that there's something that the reader doesn't know and that the reader will find out, but not to this extent. So I learned a lot while I was writing the book, and there was points where I was pulling myself back and saying, oh no, that's too soon, you can't reveal that right now, it has to be, and timing was one thing, but restraint was just as important as the timing and not showing my hand too soon. And, you know, because if you put it in too soon, the reader will guess. If you put it in too late, the reader will get irritated and it won't make sense. So I learned a lot.
It's myself. A hard thing.
And that was due by yourself before the editing.
Yes. Yeah. So really, I really enjoyed writing the book. It came out very quickly. And I think it was because Sophie was such a driving force. And I was trying to figure out Sophie out all the way through the book. I didn't really decide about Sophie until I was quite near the end. So
that's
interesting. And we can't talk any more about that, so let's move on.
No! It's always funny, though, because you kind of, as an author, I never know what's going to happen. And that's why I think I get a certain amount of joy out of it, because if I knew what was going to happen, I don't think I'd bother writing the book.
Which is what you feel when you're doing the editing. Yeah, but you know what's happening.
Fascinated with people who plot and plan and have all these... I'm fascinated with them and the fact that they do that, whereas that just makes me want to run for the hills.
Yeah, we've spoken to Candace Fox and Jeffrey Beaver. And Candace Fox and James Patterson, when they do it, they do 30,000 word...
Sort they of, have a really detailed plot outline.
Yeah.
Well, 30,000 words
detailed.
Detailed.
I know.
Yeah. And just Jeffrey Deaver's one was almost 50,000 to 70,000. And I'm thinking, you know that much already. How can you possibly
see it? Well, I'm seeing it with two writers. So, like, are you saying both of you land on the, like, you write as you don't plot it out ahead of time?
There was no plotting in Sophie whatsoever.
Wow.
Like, there was this, as I was going through, there was a spreadsheet and I was saying, right, well, we've heard from this character, they've said this, we've heard, and that was about as just organized as I was to keep track of what was happening.
But
it's funny because I was an accountant. Right, this is what people find amazing. I should be the person who's doing all the, you know, plotting and planning and spreadsheets, and I'm not. I can't explain that about myself, that when it comes to writing, I do not want to know about planning. And then, of course, if you need to change something, you have to go back and, you know, unravel everything. So sometimes I wish I did plan better.
Do you get the sense that it's more fresh?
Well, I try and surprise myself.
Yeah.
So really, the reader shouldn't have been able to guess what's happening in Sophie, because I didn't know what was going to happen. And when it came to me, what was going to happen, I was so excited. I was at the gym and I just left out this big yelp and the gym instructor thought I'd hurt myself, whereas in reality, I had just figured out what was going to happen. So
when we're reading, I should have heard your at the same time I'm going,
So
that's so interesting to me. It sort of feels like it would be really scary to write that way, but...
Well, it is. It does cause a lot of trouble. I don't recommend it. You know, it's much better to be organized. But being organized just kills the joy for me. I can't write at all. I've tried before to be organized and
it kills
my creativity.
Like spoilers kill the reader's enjoyment. If a book like this is spoiled by somebody.
Yeah.
I'm not going to spoil it.
Don't read any reviews anywhere because there's lots of spoilers already.
Yeah, so just read the book. Don't read the reviews.
Yeah.
I can't believe that people write those kind of reviews where they... on a book like this, where everyone gets the great enjoyment of not knowing, and the first thing they say in the review is, "What happens?"
Like,
it happens all the time, and it does boggle my mind. Like, I understand if you want to write a detailed review, the way to do that is to do a spoiler alert, and make sure that everyone knows before they read it that you're about to get specific. Because some people do want to talk about what happened in the book. I understand that. But to do it in the second line of a review without any warning.
Yeah. It's kind of made me think, did they not know that that was something I had withheld? Why are you blurting it out here in a review? Because it was information that was withheld from the reader for quite a while.
Sometimes I think I'm chuffed. I know it. I know what happens. I know the magician's trick.
Yeah. As a reader, I hate spoilers, and I will never feel the same again about the book if somebody tells me what's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, I much prefer reading without reading back. So someone I know recommends something to me.
Yeah.
And I trust them.
Yeah.
I try to avoid the back. I just go straight into it and just let the way the author intended those first lines, that first paragraph, those first pages to unfold. They're giving me the information in the order they wanted it.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go with them.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm a weirdo in this space because I don't... Spoilers, not spoilers, I don't mind.
Yeah.
If I'm, you know, partway through a book and I find out what happens, as long as I'm enjoying that book, I will still enjoy reading it.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, with a book like this and psychological thrillers in general, there's usually a lot of little, like, surprising... plot twist, and so that's a book where it's going to be more damaging to know than not, but I still think you can't spoil a good book.
Well, I want to be in your hands as a reader. I want the author to do exactly everything on their time, exactly when I'm meant to gasp, I'm going to gasp there, I'm going to have this information exactly. I want to be completely in the hands of the author. That's how I and spoilers take that away.
Yeah, it's interesting though, you don't even read the back of the book, because I do read the back, and that's about all I want to know, just the blurb at the back. But I'm very particular. I'm very particular about blurbs. You saw when I came in today, I was looking at the back of the Australian edition and comparing it to the back of the UK edition, and there's one line that, you know, I still want to tweak and to get it just right. You know,
in the Australian or the UK?
In the Australian one. This is the one line I just wanted to...
It might be too late.
We've got a Sharpie out there. We can just go on the back of these ones and just write your line.
This is very, very OCD, right? This is, you know, how much are you, can you say and when can you say it? And even on the back, it's important.
Certainly, if I'm in a shop and I'm browsing without any recommendation, then I'll get every piece of information the book has to offer so I can make my choice. But if someone's actually gone to the trouble of recommending and I like them and their recommendations, I'll generally just go, great.
Yeah.
Great. Now I can go completely in blind and let this author do its thing.
And it is wonderful. I actually love being recommended books because they often turn out to be a big surprise. They're often books I wouldn't read myself, and some of my favourite books are books that have been recommended to me and have been, you know, the best books I've ever read, and I would never have picked them up.
Yeah, it's great.
Well, the books like your one, I didn't read the back. I knew I had to sit here with you and talk about the book, so I went, well, I'm going to read it. So I just wanted to let you tell me the story, so I didn't read the back.
How do you do that? I compulsively read the back. I'm like, ooh, look at the cover, turn it over, read the back. I can't help it. I want to know. I want it some sort of setup.
Yeah. No, I love it. You're just sitting around a fire and someone starts to tell a story. You know, you get exactly the way they want to tell it.
I need to know what mindset to get myself in. I mean, sometimes the cover will do it, and the cover for this book is sensational. On. Yeah. I think you could just look at the cover of The Missing Pieces of Sophie McCarthy and kind of get a feel for what...
Yeah, it's a very long title, isn't it? We've just been calling her Sophie. but my mum, when she heard the title, she was like, what have you, you know, where are these pieces and where have you put them? And she was very disapproving tone of voice. When you see it, it doesn't feel as long as when you say it.
That's true.
Yeah.
Because when it's kind of a mouthful to say out loud, but not when you look at it.
Yeah. So we just call her, we've just been calling her Sophie for the last year and the Sophie book. And
Yeah. Well, you can't even do the MPOSM book.
You forgot the T.
No. Oh, okay, sorry.
Yeah. It was initially called Salt and Sophie.
Yeah.
Which was, you know.
SS.
Yes.
To Mupifism.
So you just mentioned your mum. So I read an article recently by an author who said, was trying to give authors a bit of advice, saying that he'd published 3 or 4 books and the people who didn't read it were all his loved ones. Everyone he knew, no one read it, but he had lots of great Goodreads reviews in the paper, and he sold lots of copies.
Yeah.
You've been writing for a long time now, and you've had lots of books go out. When writing and when publishing, do you still have that sense of you're looking around all your friends and family for reassurance this is going to be good, or is it you're now just like, I've got an audience out there, and they'll tell me if it's good? Like, what is it? Where are you with that?
Look, I'm probably beyond the friends and family. There are some friends who are avid readers, and their feedback is always valuable, but their feedback I get early on in the process. Mm-hmm. So I've just finished a draft of my new novel, and that's gone to those particular friends and families who are family members who are avid readers, and you know, they have an early input. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to this stage, it's the reader, the general reader, and what they think of it. Luckily, it's not my mom, who's certainly not impressed by the title. Because she can be very critical.
I do like that feedback. What are these missing pieces, and where did you put them?
I think she's worried about how her friends perceive everything. You know, her. Yeah. I have to edit that part out.
Who's writing the new one? Is it BM or is it?
It's BM.
Okay.
Yeah. Are we allowed to know anything about it, or is it too early?
Well, I can say it's about a school reunion that goes a bit dangerous. But there are lots of perspectives again, and it's written in a really difficult tense, and I am, tied myself up in a few knots, really, to be honest. I didn't intend that. It's because it's a school reunion. There's a lot of different perspectives, naturally. So
I like that.
Yeah.
Do you reckon there's influence of on TV, on big like, dramas, the crime dramas on TV with so many different characters, and the way in which we can flip between characters in those kind of long series that we seem to be addicted to on Netflix.
Yeah.
Do you reckon that has an influence in the way your structure was built, in the way that you can flip between characters so easily on TV?
Look, no. It didn't at the time. And to be honest, it's not an easy way to write.
Yeah.
So I don't recommend it. I'm not quite too sure I went off and did it again. I certainly won't be doing it a third time. So it is a difficult way to write. I think maybe on screen it's easier. Because on screen you can see what somebody looks like. You can hear their voice. Everybody's very distinct. And when you're writing, it's much more difficult to achieve that. I don't know. It was the way the story came out. And it was this whole idea that when something that devastating happens, the ripple effect, the people who are impacted, and the best way to do that seemed to be, you know, and I really thought when I submitted it first, I was expecting a "Have you gone insane?" response, and I was quite surprised when I didn't get that response. So
it was your attention to try and give that sense that this one incident affected all these people, and so you can't tell a story without having them all have their say.
I wanted a climax where they all had a part in making it happen, in what happened.
I love
either
I
directly
love
or indirectly. So
the feeling of something fragmented and smashed, and then drawing all those pieces together.
Yeah,
like. It's fascinating.
I was reading something the other day where a crime writer said they never read any crime before writing their own. Are you a fan of this kind of writing, or is this something that you've just come to because of the story demand?
I am a fan of this type of writing. And actually I was driven into this type of writing because I was I am a very avid reader. So I read lots, and every time somebody gives me a book or recommends a book, I always make a point of reading the book. So I do read very widely. But there was a point in, you know, the Australian market in particular, where there was very little contemporary fiction being published. And there was a lot of psychological thrillers and dramas. And as a book purchaser, I was forced to probably buy more of those books than what I would normally buy. And there were some that I would read and I would think, oh, well, that's far too dark for me. That's gone too far for my taste. And then others where I would read, I'd say, that's just perfect.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't imagine writing a book in a genre you've never even read before.
I've read it. It's been quite successful.
In fact, I can't imagine being a writer at all unless you're a pretty big reader, because
they're a reader, but that's one.
Yeah, to me, it's like so interconnected, writing and reading. And, you know, I spent half my life despairing when I just finished a really good book and thinking, oh my God, that's so good, why do I even bother? You do get those moments of feeling, you know, even extra motivated. Sometimes it has one effect, sometimes it has the other, but I could never stop reading. So I did read, probably coming up to this book, I read more. I had been reading more in that genre, but at the end of the day, the book was sparked by something that happened to a distant acquaintance of mine, and you know, she was badly injured due to the carelessness of somebody else, and it was really that spark and that strong idea of Sophie, you know, who I'd met many times in the corporate world. I had really a really strong sense of, you know, who this person was, and that really drove the book. Probably helped that I'd been reading a little bit more in the genre. Maybe with my timing a bit more.
Okay, we're not that interested in books here at the Booktopia podcast. Have you got any books stood out that you went, oh,
yeah,
that'd be...
Reading Rex.
Goodness. Well, I've just finished reading the Benjamin Stevenson one, and I have to say I absolutely love that. You'll have read all of the books that I would recommend.
That's Green Light. Yeah.
Just finished reading that, you know, two nights ago, and I stayed up really late reading it. I thought, what a great example of Australian fiction. And it's not quite crime, but it's softer than crime. It is a psychological thriller, suspense. Yeah. But it's not dark, it's not total out and out crime.
Yeah.
I read, and this one was probably too dark, but I really liked it, The Widow, Fiona Barton.
Yeah. Oh, wow, yeah.
I have lots of them. I can't think of them off the top of my head, but I mean, you would have read them all, but that was very dark, but so well done. Mm. The voice in that was so distinctive. And I always remember her saying, her husband, and he's nonsense. And I could just see her in my head saying that. And I just thought it was very well done.
No, that's a great book.
It is a very good book.
She's got another one that was good as well. I don't know if you'd read it, and I might get this wrong, but I think it's called The Child.
Right.
Am I right?
I'm not sure.
I'm really sorry if I'm wrong, but I believe that it's called The Child, also by Fiona Bunn. Yeah. Also really good.
And there was a lot of books I bought, because a lot of them, the covers are very similar, so I'm struggling to remember some of the names, but, you know, that's dark cover... Dark cover, you know, yeah, they're reminiscent of Gone Girl. And, of course, there was the Gone Girl and Girl on the Train, and which were all excellent books. That,
did you read Dry and
Wimmer
and all those?
Yes, I read Dry. I love Dry. I think I read Dry in one sitting as well. I'm just terrible when I get a good book. It's like getting a big bar of chocolate and eating it all at once. And the next day feeling really guilty and thinking, now I've got nothing to read. And I've just, you know, why didn't I show some restraint?
Well, this is a book like yours is designed for us to show no restraint, right? You don't want people to be picking it up. I'll read an hour today and an hour tomorrow and then 6 weeks later and then another hour.
Well, no, you do kind of, with books like that, you've got to be committed to reading them in a short space of time. My husband drives me crazy because it takes a long time to read a book. And if he reads a book that is a psychological thriller, by the time he's got to the end, he's missed all the clues. He's forgotten them.
Yeah.
And it's infuriating. And I kind of, when I see him taking one of those books, I take them off him and I say, you're not reading that till the holidays. Mm. And I know you'll read it in a couple of days.
Because otherwise, author,
exactly. Here's something that where it doesn't matter, you know.
It's if supposed you miss, to be a wild ride.
Exactly. Well, you can't miss things in that book. You can't. Yeah. Conclusion will make no sense if you've missed the pointers and the signposts and the, you know. So they have to be read quickly, but, you know, not silly like me in one sitting, but
fairly quickly.
Fairly quickly.
Well, if you've got a rainy Sunday, you know, what's wrong with spending a rainy Sunday reading a book?
Yeah. Yeah, but there are all these other days in the week, and sometimes you want to start a book on a Tuesday. Yeah. And
there's nothing worse than getting up the next morning and feeling like you've been out in the town, but what you've been doing is reading a book.
Sarah's now got the perfect job, because you know, she now has her job is to wake up feeling terrible in the morning because she's read a thriller until 3 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah, which is something that I've always done, but now I get to say it's my job.
Oh, Sarah, you sound like the best job ever.
It's pretty good. Once they start paying me for reading time, I'll be happy.
Good luck with that. We can have a whole podcast on that. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to
us. You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
And you can get hold of The Missing Pieces of Sophie McCarthy at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.